The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It does show the sort of strain that the market is under this winter.
It's very rare to hear the chief economist of the Bank of England being so frank about Brexit.
I think that what's more problematic for policy in the UK is following these basics so that people make decisions on the basis of the full picture.
Stephen, I would like to have a small rant.
Oh, just a small one. That's a relief.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. Now, coming up on today's programme, we're going to break down the latest jobs data with Bloomberg Economics' Dan Hansen in just a moment. Unemployment actually rose unexpectedly to 3.8% in the UK. But Lizzie, the number that stood out to me was all about strikes.
Yeah, the UK's lost more than 3 million working days since industrial action escalated last summer, and the unions are planning another wave of protests in the weeks ahead. 3/5 of the days lost in the last month were in the education sector.
Yeah, a big problem if you've got kids. And I think in these days of work from home, it's much more difficult if teachers are on strike than if perhaps, you know, the trains go on strike. So, you know, a big problem for lots of households.
Yeah, we know how to work from home.
Yeah, exactly. That's easy these days. Separate NHS data showed that just shy of 200,000 appointments had to be cancelled because of that four-day junior doctor strike last week. And that's likely to be an underestimate because many hospitals avoided booking appointments on those days. NHS England say that at the height of the walkout, the more than 27,000 staff not at work last
week. I know,
week.
It's totally staggering figures, especially when you then layer in the fact that Network Rail has revealed that train delays are actually going to get worse over the next 5 years because of rising costs and funding. Going back to the education point, you know, the real concern also, I think, in the education sector is that people get out of the habit of going to school. It's not just about sort of work from home. Parents get used to having them there, and that's sort of really, really tricky. But yeah, also that Network Rail and the strike action on trains is going to get more difficult.
Yes, education, healthcare, transport, public services really taking a bashing at the moment. And Lizzie, as well as the inconvenience from all of this, also showing up in some of the economic data as well.
Yeah, in the GDP data last week, but also in the jobs numbers today. For a broader look at those numbers from the Office for National Statistics, we've got on the line our senior UK economist, Dan Hansen. Dan, we saw in the figures today that the labour market was tighter than expected. Why?
So hi everyone. So I think the thing to look at, there were two things that struck me when it sort of hit the wire at 7 a.m. So the first thing that dropped was the unemployment number, and I thought, well, that's actually a little bit higher than I expected. We thought there was only 3.7%, actually it was 3.8%, but in the broad context of things, that is still extremely tight. There is, you know, there's still a lot of demand there for workers. We're seeing some easing of the supply constraints in the labour market, which is some good news, but the broad picture is still a high degree of tightness in the labour market. And then, of course, we saw these wage numbers, which were surprising, not only because of the scale of the revisions to the back data, but also there was signs of renewed momentum in wage growth, particularly in the private sector. So I think those two things combined, you bring them together, jobs market is still pretty hot and against a backdrop of an economy that's holding up better than expected, and wage growth is proving very, very sticky.
Yeah, that wage growth number, average earnings excluding bonuses, up 6.6% in the latest 3 months on a year ago. Yeah, pretty punchy. Just dig down into that for us a little bit. How much of that is because of that tightness in the labour market?
Yeah, so I think the thing to think about when you decompose wage growth and think about what's driven it, you know, you're right, past tightness of the labour market affects pay growth today. So there's a lag there between the tightening of the labour market and how that shows up in pay growth. There's also the expectation of workers and firms about prices and wages in the future. And that, of course, affects the bargaining process between workers and firms. And there's been a lot of evidence that has been actually the key driver of the pickup in wages, that people are expecting higher inflation, so are bargaining for higher wages. And actually, I think there's a combination of the two in the UK, that combination of a very tight labour market, very high inflation. It puts workers in a strong position to bargain for a bigger slice of the pie, essentially. So I think those are the things that can really explain it. And if you sort of run it through models, it's really that rise in expectations about future inflation that's been driving the pickup in wages in the UK.
There's also the issue around who is active, who is economically inactive. So the numbers around economic inactivity fell. But when you look specifically at long-term sickness, which has been a big focus, that's now at a record high. The government has picked up on this, and surely they must be incredibly concerned by this latest data.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And there are some signs the broader picture on participation is easing and inactivity is falling. But you're right, Caroline, that is a real issue here in the UK. We've got these two sort of factors at play. We've got the long-term sickness story, and you've also got the early retiree story. And the government we saw in the budget, the government has made some attempt to sort of address this. But if you look at what the OBR said about how much of an impact these policies could have, they're likely to be pretty small, and I sort of share that sentiment. So I think it's a very difficult thing to deal with from a policy perspective, both the long-term sickness and early retirement. And it's really difficult to change, you know, bring people back in when those are the two reasons why, back into the labour market, when they're the two reasons why inactivity has risen in the first place.
So if you take all this together and it looks like the labour market's tighter than expected, do you still think that February's upside inflation surprise was just, as you put it, Dan, a blip? We get the inflation data tomorrow. Do you still think it's going to fall into single digits for March?
Yeah. So that, I mean, the way to think about it is that the economy performs in a certain way. That feeds through to the labour market. That affects wages. And then ultimately that affects inflation. So what we will see tomorrow in the inflation data is a reflection of something that happened in the economy and labour market maybe a year even further back. So I think when you look at this today, the CPI data tomorrow, I should say, you'll be getting some information about what happened in the past. There'll be a little bit of information about what's happened with energy prices as well. But we are still expecting a fall. To go directly to your question, we're expecting a fall to 9.8%. I think what we found out today, though, with the labour market data is what might happen to inflation further down the line. And it kind of speaks to the view that, yes, inflation will fall this year because of what we know about base effects on the energy side, and we've had a fall in wholesale energy costs as well. But actually, when you strip all that out and you get to the underlying picture, it's still very sticky, and the pay growth numbers today are likely to mean that it remains sticky going forward.
Now, Dan, just less than a month now until the next Bank of England rate decision. The market was already expecting another quarter point rise in interest rates, but you weren't. So you've now changed your call on this, haven't you?
Yeah, we have. So, you know, the bank has set out its framework for thinking about the data that's coming up, and it's looking, so quite clearly, it's been looking at private sector, or it is looking at private sector pay growth. It's looking at services inflation, and it's looking at the labour market more generally. And I think if you look at today's, we've got CPI tomorrow, but if you look at today's data, it's such a big surprise, I think, relative to what we were thinking, to what consensus was thinking, and I think to what the Bank of England would have been thinking as well, although it's not completely clear what their forecast would have been. I think it's very hard to see them not responding to this in May now, with another quarter point hike. As I say, we'll get the inflation data tomorrow and they'll be watching the services inflation print. But I think going back to my previous answer, the fact that we're getting this pickup in this reacceleration, if you like, in pay growth and evidence of that in the underlying data, that will worry the bank about what's going to happen to inflation further out. And remember, that's what they're worried about. They're worried about the picture sort of 2 years ahead. There's nothing they can do with interest rates now that'll affect inflation today.
Okay, so then for listeners who are sort of concerned around rates, where do you think interest rates in the UK are going to peak? We've had, 11 rises in a row. Do you think it's going to be around September? That seems to be the expectation for most people, that that's when rates will peak in Britain.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, we think now we've added a hike to our path. So our peak is now 4.5%. I think the market is peaking at 4.75%, but that is a slow rise from May up to September in market pricing. So there's one more hike over the summer, essentially being priced in. I think one reason to think that May might be a point at which the bank stops is that two or three weeks after the bank will release its forecasts and give its May decision on May the 11th, you'll get the May CPI, the April CPI data, but it's obviously released in May. And in that, you'll get a very big fall in inflation, 2 percentage points, 2.5 percentage points. And that, as I say, is a mechanical thing, but I think it's something that the bank will be able to hang its hat on and say, look, and it's something that Bailey has been speaking about, this sort of fall in inflation that'll take hold. He's mentioning the spring and sort of push that out a little bit to the summer, but that'll be the first point at which they can really point to the inflation data and say, look, this thing is starting to come down. So we've got a peak of 4.5% in our forecast, a little bit lower than market expectations. But I think if the inflation data does move favorably in this mechanical way that seems almost is baked in, I think that'll give them room to pause.
Yeah, it's not the news that people want to hear when we also saw real incomes falling again in the latest data. I just want to come back to strikes, Dan, because we saw in the numbers today 348,000 working days lost to strikes in February. It's up from January. And we already saw the hit to GDP from strike action in February. The economy, of course, only flatlined. Do you expect the more of the same is coming down the pipeline if strikes continue, and you've got the Royal College of Nursing threatening to continue industrial action until Christmas?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think what we've seen is, as you say, you've had the rise in the number of working days lost between January and February, and I think it's likely that you'll get another increase between February and March, which will again impact the GDP figures. I think, interestingly, the Bank of England's probably looking for something like that as well, because it's maintained quite a downbeat view about the first quarter. It still thinks the economy will contract. We think output will rise by a little bit. But I think the thing to remember is that if the number of strike days stays the same, say it stayed the same from February throughout the rest of the year, the level of output would be suppressed, because obviously fewer working hours are taking place. But it won't continually hit the growth rate of the economy. What you need to see there is that more strike days are happening from month to month and increasing month to month. And that would suppress the growth rate and continue to push down on the level of GDP. So yes, the level of GDP has been suppressed by the strikes. We don't think it's a huge impact, but it admittedly has been bigger than we initially thought it would be. And, you know, it gives the Prime Minister and the Chancellor some food for thought, certainly.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us. That's Dan Hansen, our senior UK economist. Interesting thoughts on the economic impact of all those strikes.
Well, of course, one way that the government's trying actually to address economic activity is by expanding childcare provision. This was another addition to the Chancellor's last budget. The Prime Minister, though, has found himself in some hot water around this issue. I will refer to the Daily Star, the headline here is dishy, rishy, fishy. More seriously, though, it's that the Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards, Daniel Greenberg, has reportedly opened an inquiry into whether the Prime Minister properly declared his wife, Akshata Murty's, minority stake in a childcare business here in the UK, familiar to many parents, Coru Kids. So this is the investigation that we reported.
Yeah, look, it's not likely to pose a major threat to the Prime Minister, but it is a distraction from his rhetoric about competent government. But on the childcare policy itself, I want to bring in Bloomberg's UK economy reporter Lucy White. She reports today that UK nurseries say the plan to increase free childcare hours is, quote, unworkable. Lucy, thanks for being in the studio with us. Why unworkable?
So this is some research that we've heard from the National Day Nurseries Association. And what they're basically saying is that their members are telling them, it's great that we're getting extra funding. It's great that we're seeing childcare being free childcare being expanded to 1 and 2 year olds. But at the same time, the funding level probably isn't going to be enough for them to actually expand. And they're facing so much trouble with hiring staff and trying to find the premises to fit these nurseries into, that it's unlikely to actually make much difference. So, for example, 35% of nurseries don't think that these measures suggested in the budget are actually going to lead to more children being in their setting. 75% of nurseries, for example, already have a waiting list for 1 and 2 year olds before you even start giving them, before you even start extending free childcare to those ages.
Okay, I mean, I will reflect the frustration of parents up and down the land then. I mean, this was sold as a sort of big idea to solve the issue of exorbitantly high childcare costs in Britain. It was going to give free hours, even though I think one can take issue with the idea of free because it's not always free at the point of delivery. It's a subsidy by government to nurseries actually for those extra hours. So why is it so limited then as it turns out?
I think you've just got to look at it in the context of Jeremy Hunt being very constrained in the amount of money he's able to spend at the moment. The measures that he's set out are only kind of, looking at paying salaries at the current level. Obviously, it's not taking into account any rise in salaried level. And at the moment, there's a lot of cross-subsidisation that goes on with the younger 1 and 2 year olds. Parents are paying fees that are higher for those 1 and 2 year olds to cross-subsidise the government fees that are being paid for the 3 and 4 year olds. And when the government starts paying for the 1 and 2 year olds as well, you don't have the flexibility to be able to charge those higher fees anymore. So a lot of nurseries, perhaps if they do take on the free hours, are going to find it harder to make ends meet.
Incredible stat from the National Day Nurseries Association. They say that 40% of nurseries say that the estimate that they're losing £2.31 for every hour of childcare is an underestimate. So you wonder how these nurseries are continuing in business. What is it that they would like to see? Is it as simple as a load more money?
A load more money would help. But I mean, a lot of them want to see a workforce strategy, is what they're saying. They want to be able to hire. They want more freedom to be able to hire. But of course, you need to look at how you're attracting people to the profession. You need to look at the qualifications people are expected to have. In some cases, you need to look at the amount of children per worker, the ratio of how many people, how many children these workers are able to look after. The chief executive of the NDNA actually said to me, in a lot of cases, workers are seeing better pay and better conditions at a supermarket than a nursery. So, why would you do it?
Well, what a question to end on. Lucy White, thanks for being with us in the studio on the state of childcare.
Well, yesterday, the City Minister, Andrew Griffiths, told us that they're working on reforms to capital markets, which will make it a more attractive place to list. Of course, this is a big problem for the City of London in recent years.
Yeah, absolutely. It includes companies like the battery manufacturer Amty Power, which listed on London's AIM back in 2021. So Bloomberg's Tom McKenzie and I spoke to the CEO of Amty Power a little earlier this morning, Alan Hollis. We asked him, of course, in the face of these huge US subsidies for green technology, surely that would be just too tempting to reject.
We're now at the stage of commercialization and planning significant investment in gigafactory scale production. And as part of that process, of course, we have to consider all of the options that we've got available. I have to say we've been very well supported by the UK government and the Scottish government over the previous years in helping us develop the technology. But now, as we're talking about scaling up, the quantum of investment required, goes to a completely different level. And like many businesses, you'd expect us to be looking at, the options that are available. We are a British company who have developed the technology in the UK. We want to build our gigafactory at our preferred site in Dundee. But, as a matter of course, we must consider all of the options, and in particular, the benefits that appear to be provided by the Inflation Reduction Act in the US.
Alan, very interesting. Thank you for joining us this morning. So it sounds like, just correct me if I'm wrong, you have yet to make that decision and that firm commitment on Dundee. If you haven't, what do you need to see to kind of move the dial and to lock that in for Dundee?
We need to continue the discussions with the Scottish government, and the UK government, to look to see how we can provide a comparable level of support and incentives that are available to the provided by the US Inflation Reduction Act. I'm sure and I'm very hopeful that we can get there, but it just seems that the UK at the moment is significantly behind. The US, the Inflation Reduction Act came out in August last year. The EU's Green Industrial Deal, came out in February this year, and yet we're still waiting for a strong strategy and support proposal to come out of the UK government, and that's only promised in September. So the time for all of these, planning cycle for a business like ours is long, and the more surety and security that we can have in terms of making our investment decisions, the better it is. So the time to act is now.
Okay, how close are you really to a gigafactory in Britain? The collapse of British Volt after years was a significant blow, although kind of long expected in some ways, I think. How close are you to actually creating something for the UK, a gigafactory?
It takes time to develop the technology, to plan a gigafactory scale production, and then to implement and build that facility, and to ramp it up to full scale production. We are confident in our plans.
Give me a ballpark, Alan. Is that 5, 10, 20 years? Give me something to go on.
It's close to the 5-year timescale. We all see on the news and in everything that we read that the demand for batteries, whether it's to provide power for electric vehicles or whether it's to capture renewable energy that's created by wind and solar, those markets are just growing and growing and growing, and they're essential in to support our drive to net zero. And we're not thinking of putting a gigafactory, getting it up and running in 20 years' time. Far from it. It's the 5-year timescale that is what we're working to.
The Chancellor has already made it quite clear that the UK can't possibly go toe-to-toe with the US or even with Europe when it comes to subsidies. Is that the drive here? Or is it perhaps to, prepare for, if there is, let's say, a Labour government in a couple of years' time, to get them to get an industrial strategy right? What is your response?
As I've said previously, it's all about time. The time to act is now. Because there's no question that as a country we're facing competition from other nations and other regions, particularly in electric vehicles and energy storage. But in the UK we have the potential to support these requirements, but we do need the government to support us to develop the industry to help meet the environmental goals, because that's the key driver in everything we're doing. And the next important point is about creating security of supply, because if we want to grow and maintain these industries, we have to invest and we have to have a clear strategy. We have to encourage inward investment, which ultimately creates the jobs, the highly skilled jobs that we're looking to do. This is an investment for any government, whether it's Conservative or Labour.
Alan, on the question of jobs, we had wage growth pictures, wage growth, inflation coming out stronger than expected today in terms of some of the data, UK employment data. How challenging is it to find skilled workers for your kind of business? Are you seeing any signs that it's becoming easier? What is the picture when it comes to attracting and retaining staff?
Well, we're investing heavily in retaining staff and growing and developing our own internal team wherever we can. But as we're a rapidly growing business, we do need to bring people into our organization. And that is a challenging thing to do because, we need to create and support the industry, which then encourages people to go into the industry, to go into the university system or through apprenticeships to learn the skills, who then come out and we can then employ. But you need the industry there in the first place. My fear is that with the lack of action from the government at the moment, we potentially see companies in the sectors that we're operating migrating to other parts of the world because the financial models are better there.
So that was Alan Hollis, the CEO of Amty Power, speaking to me and to Tom McKenzie earlier on Bloomberg Radio. Look, pressing the absolute need for an industrial strategy now in the UK so that Britain can reach its green goals and, create jobs, keep up with the US and Europe and be energy independent. I thought it was a really interesting interview.
Yeah, so much money flooding into these green technologies in the US and increasingly in Europe as well. I want to bring you an update on another politics story we've been following. That's an update on the investigation into the funding and finances of the SNP. Party Treasurer Colin Beattie, who's also an MSP, has been arrested by Police Scotland and taken into custody to be questioned by detectives. Now, Beattie was SNP Treasurer for 16 years until 2020 before meeting in an internal election. The man who beat him quit after saying that he'd not received the support or financial information needed to carry out the job. Beattie then returned to the role. The arrest, of course, comes 2 weeks after former SNP Chief Executive Peter Morrell, Nicola Sturgeon's husband, was also arrested. He was later released without charge, pending further investigation. So we'll keep watching this story.
Yeah, the other thing I've been watching from Scotland is the idea from the new SNP leader, the First Minister, Humza Yousaf, to have 44% income tax on anyone earning more than £75,000 above the border. Merin Somerset Webb, our columnist and podcaster, she says, that seems like a bad idea. She says this on Twitter. People will just go to England and pay 40%.
There's already quite a big tax gap, isn't there, with Scotland for sort of, what would you call them, upper middle earners, I suppose. People who probably don't consider themselves rich. But that gap has been expanding over the years. So, yeah, interesting debate.
Yeah, no, absolutely. One to watch, the issue around tax. Look, that's all we've got time for, though, for today. I hope you enjoyed the programme. Don't forget to subscribe. Give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Walcock and our audio engineer was Marufal Hussain. I'm Ewan Potts.
I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.